Imagine you're driving a company utility truck.
Right.
Just on a regular Tuesday afternoon.
Okay.
And you've got your arm resting out the window the way literally anyone does on a warm day.
Yeah.
And you casually let your fingers fall into, like, an okay sign, stretching your hand out.
Right. Just a normal stretch.
Exactly.
Right.
But someone on the sidewalk snaps a photo of your truck. And by the time you clock out and get home, that photo has been shared tens of thousands of times online.
Wow.
Yeah, and an entirely fabricated narrative has formed. People are claiming your casual hand stretch was actually this covert white supremacist gang symbol.
Mm.
The internet mob tags your employer. The phones are ringing off the hook.
It's a complete firestorm.
A massive firestorm. And by Wednesday morning, without an investigation, without anyone even asking for your side of the story,
yeah,
you are fired. Your livelihood, your reputation, your entire sense of security, just gone instantly. Because of an algorithmic frenzy that lacked, you know, a single shred of context.
I mean, it sounds like dystopian fiction, but it is a very real documented event. And it perfectly encapsulates this psychological threshold that we are standing on today. Because, well, when an entire society watches an event like that unfold, it sends a profound, like a chilling shockwave through our collective nervous system.
It really does.
We learn very quickly and very viscerally that the world is unpredictable, unforgiving, and completely out of our control.
And today is July 1st, 2026. And I want to say directly to you, listening right now, if you've ever watched a story like that and felt just a cold knot of dread in your stomach, or, you know, if you've been looking at the skyrocketing climate anxiety, the massive institutional decline, and this dizzying pace of technological disruption, and you just feel entirely paralyzed, you're not alone.
Not at all.
It feels like the world is just buckling under the weight of an intersecting polycrisis.
Yeah, polycrisis is exactly the right word for it. We aren't just dealing with isolated problems anymore. The architecture of the modern world is experiencing severe compounding strain. I mean, the symptoms are everywhere, deepening social divisions, pervasive systemic injustices, and just a suffocating, overarching uncertainty about the future.
Right.
But what we often fail to realize is that this isn't just a geopolitical issue or, you know, an economic one. It is fundamentally a psychological and spiritual crisis.
And that is exactly what we are going to unpack today. The mission for this deep dive is to cut straight through that suffocating uncertainty and figure out how to actually reclaim our personal agency. We've been pulling apart an incredible synthesis of ideas lately, a framework called Moral Courage in a Fragmented World.
It's a fascinating body of work.
It really is. It brings together behavioral psychology, modern sociology, and some deeply profound metaphysical philosophies from texts like Fractal the Trilogy and the Oracle 2.0.
And what makes the synthesis so vital right now is that it refuses to stay on the surface. It doesn't just analyze the politics or the economics of the polycrisis. It demands that we look inward.
Right, into the human mind.
Exactly, at the internal landscape of the soul. It asks us to examine the actual mechanics of why we feel so powerless and what it takes to break out of that state.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're going to look at human morality not as a static, carved-in-stone monument, but as a living muscle. Right now, the way our society is structured has essentially put that moral muscle into a full body cast.
It's atrophying.
It is atrophying. And today, we're going to talk about physical therapy for the soul. But before we can get to the rehabilitation, we have to understand the immediate psychological environment we are living in. We can't cure the disease without understanding the pathogen. So why are we so frozen?
To understand the modern freeze response, we actually have to rewind a bit. Back to the 1960s, to a foundational moment in behavioral psychology. Psychologist Martin Seligman conducted a series of seminal experiments that uncovered a phenomenon he called learned helplessness.
Okay.
And the mechanics of this are absolutely crucial to understand.
Break down the actual experiment for us because the visual of it is so striking.
So Seligman was working with dogs. He placed them in an enclosure where the floor would deliver a mild but uncomfortable electrical shock. Initially, he had two groups. One group of dogs compress a panel with their nose to turn off the shock.
So they had agency.
Right, they had agency. The other group had no control at all. No matter what they did, the shock would just continue randomly.
And they quickly figure out that their actions just don't matter.
Exactly. But here is the terrifying part of the experiment. In the next phase, Seligman took all the dogs and put them in a new enclosure. This time, it was a box with a low partition right in the middle. The shock was applied to one side, but all the dogs had to do to escape the shock was simply hop over the low barrier to the safe side.
Just a quick jump?
A tiny jump. The dogs who previously had control easily jumped over the barrier. But the dogs from the second group, the ones who had been conditioned to believe they had no control, didn't even try.
They didn't even try.
No, they just laid down on the floor and endured the shock. Even with a clear, incredibly easy avenue of escape right in front of them, they remained completely passive. They had internalized the belief that their environment was entirely out of their hands.
They literally learned to be helpless.
Yes.
And when we take that concept that repeated exposure to uncontrollable adverse events just breaks the will to act and we map it onto the digital landscape of 2026, it is chillingly identical.
It perfectly diagnoses the modern condition. Think about the daily experience of the average citizen today. You wake up, you open your newsfeed, and what happens?
Disaster.
You are instantly bombarded with a relentless, high-velocity stream of uncontrollable global disasters, a pandemic variant in one hemisphere, a war breaking out in another, ecological collapse, economic instability.
Mm-hmm.
It is catastrophic forecasting on an endless loop.
It's the floor shocking us over and over, and we don't have the panel to turn it off.
Precisely. And chronic exposure to these macro stressors creates a psychological environment where individuals begin to perceive their own daily micro actions as entirely irrelevant to the trajectory of the world. I mean, why bother trying to jump the barrier if the whole world is on fire?
Right.
And it's vital to recognize that this isn't just a philosophical malaise. It isn't just a bad mood or pessimism. There is a deeply rooted neurobiology to this despair.
Because our bodies haven't evolved to process global trauma.
Hmm.
I mean, if you're an ancient human, a threat is a tiger chasing you or a neighboring tribe attacking. Your body dumps cortisol and adrenaline into your system so you can run away or fight. But how do you run away from a geopolitical crisis on your phone?
You can't. You physically cannot. So your body's stress response systems remain chronically activated. And when you are constantly bathed in cortisol, it leads to profound physiological exhaustion, apathy, and deep existential anxiety. Contemporary research, particularly focusing on emerging adults in their late teens and 20s, shows that doom scrolling acts as a massive catalyst for this neurobiological state.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When people compulsively engage with distressing digital content, it radically amplifies their existential concerns regarding fate, death, and just total meaninglessness.
Which brings up the negativity bias, which feels like the core engine of this entire machine.
Oh, absolutely. The human brain has an evolutionary predisposition to focus heavily on threats. To use your ancient human example, if you were walking through the savannah, you need to pay much more attention to the rustling bush that might be a predator than the beautiful sunset.
Right, because ignoring the sunset won't kill you.
But ignoring the rustling bush will.
And now algorithms are ruthlessly exploiting that ancient brain wiring.
They are meticulously engineered to maximize human engagement through that exact negativity bias. And this creates a highly destructive, self-sustaining feedback loop. Let's trace the loop for a second. A person feels generally anxious about the state of the world.
Naturally.
So to regain a sense of control or preparedness, they turn to their screen to gather information. But because the media ecology is built to prioritize emotional shock and spectacle over nuance, the algorithm feeds them the most distressing, catastrophic content available.
So instead of feeling informed, their anxiety spikes even further.
Exactly. Their perception of reality becomes heavily distorted toward the negative. They feel even less in control, and they plunge deeper into that state of learned helplessness.
But wait, I have to push back here for a second.
Yeah.
Isn't there a difference between being helpless and just being genuinely bone deep exhausted?
Yeah.
Are these algorithms actually engineering this paralysis in us? Or are they just acting as a mirror reflecting our own societal exhaustion back at us? I mean, life is genuinely hard right now. Maybe we're just tired.
That's a great question. But what's fascinating here is that the neurological data shows it is not merely a reflection. It is an active suppression of our higher cognitive functions. The media ecology has evolved to a point where it is actively short-circuiting critical thought.
Really?
Yeah. When you are constantly bombarded with emotional shock, outrage, fear, panic, your brain is forced into a state of hyperarousal. You are operating almost entirely out of your amygdala, which is the primitive fear center of the brain.
It's the alarm bell.
Yes, it's the alarm bell. And when the alarm bell is ringing, blood flow and energy are literally diverted away from the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain responsible for nuanced analysis, delayed gratification, and complex moral reasoning.
Wow.
So the algorithms aren't just reflecting your exhaustion. By keeping you in a state of continuous low-grade panic, they are physically disabling the part of your brain required to think your way out of the problem. It is manufactured passivity.
Wow. Okay, so if the learned helplessness doesn't get you, there is a second massive pillar holding up this architecture of powerlessness, and that is social conformity.
Yes. Compounding the paralysis of learned helplessness is the incredibly powerful human drive to belong. To understand this, we look at Solomon Asch's foundational conformity experiments from the 1950s.
This is one of my absolute favorite psychological studies because it is so incredibly revealing about human nature.
It truly is. Asch wanted to see how much social pressure could affect a person's willingness to accept an obvious truth. So he put a single subject in a room with a group of actors who the subject thought were just other regular participants.
Okay.
He would show the group a card with one vertical line on it and then another card with three lines of varying length. He asked everyone in the room to state aloud which of the three lines matched the first line.
And the answer was always incredibly obvious. It wasn't a trick question.
It was completely unambiguous. But Asch had secretly instructed the actors to confidently give the wrong answer.
So you're the one real subject sitting there looking at a line that is clearly 3 inches long and five people before you confidently state that it matches the line that is 6 inches long.
Exactly. And the results were staggering. Asch demonstrated that the desire to belong to a group, the deep-seated fear of standing out or being ostracized, is so strong that it can frequently override objective reality. A massive percentage of the subjects would literally look at clear physical evidence, doubt their own eyes, and agree with the group's incorrect answer just to not be the odd one out.
That is wild.
They surrendered their own clear evidence and internal convictions for the safety of the herd.
And you see this exact dynamic playing out on a terrifying scale today with what we broadly call cancel culture, or online mob dynamics. The threat of social ostracization acts as a severe, almost total deterrent to moral courage. People learn very quickly that questioning the accepted narratives of whatever their ideological in-group happens to be carries an immense social penalty.
Which brings us right back to your opening example of the utility worker. The viral firestorm that cost him his job completely lacked context, but the sheer overwhelming volume of collective rage created a reality distortion field. Once the mob decided the gesture was malicious, objective truth no longer mattered.
It didn't matter at all.
No. The company fired him not based on an investigation of facts, but as a compliance mechanism to the group's outrage to avoid becoming the next target.
Which is terrifying for anyone watching from the sidelines. Because what you learn from observing an event like that is that stepping out of line, or even just attempting to introduce a little bit of nuance, saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's more to this story, invites absolute destruction.
Exactly. And consequently, people retreat into echo chambers. They curate their online lives and their real-world conversations to ensure they never bump up against the edges of their group's acceptable orthodoxy. They prioritize their social safety over their ethical integrity.
Right.
But the crucial, deeply empathetic insight we have to pull from this is that this retreat isn't necessarily apathy.
It's not that people don't care.
No, not at all. It is a highly calculated survival mechanism in a society that aggressively punishes nuance and rewards rigid ideological compliance. When the fear of being targeted by your own tribe outweighs your commitment to the truth, society fundamentally loses its capacity for civil discourse. We become paralyzed not just by the scale of the world's problems, but by the terror of each other.
It's like we're being crushed in a vise. On one side, the sheer scale of global catastrophes makes us feel like nothing we do matters. And on the other side, the hypersensitivity of our social groups makes us feel like if we do anything, we'll be destroyed. So we freeze.
We completely freeze.
But here's where we have to pivot. Having established how these external forces, the algorithms and the social mobs, paralyze us, we need to look at what happens inside the human heart when it is held in that state of paralysis for years. If we are too scared to speak up, if we're too exhausted to act, what happens to our internal moral compass?
It's a dark question.
It is. Here's where it gets really interesting. Because your moral compass doesn't just shatter overnight in one dramatic explosion. It slowly, quietly fades away. Ethical fading is like carbon monoxide poisoning. You don't realize the air in the room is turning toxic because it's completely odorless. It's incremental. You just sit there breathing it in, thinking everything is fine, until you're completely incapacitated.
That is the perfect analogy for behavioral ethics and the reality of systemic corruption. We have been conditioned by movies and history books to think that the erosion of integrity is the result of a single catastrophic ethical failure.
Like a villain.
Right. We picture a cartoonish villain making a dramatic choice to be evil. But in reality, it is a slow, incremental attrition of the soul. Researchers Anton Brunsel and David Messick pioneered this concept, literally calling it ethical fading.
How does that actually play out in real life? Say I'm a mid-level manager working at a massive logistics corporation, or a head nurse at an underfunded hospital. I consider myself a good person. How does my ethics fade?
It happens when you are placed in high-pressure environments that are overwhelmingly focused on metrics performance, profit margins, patient turnover, or simply institutional survival. Over time, unconsciously, the individuals in these systems begin to reframe deep, profound ethical dilemmas as mere business decisions.
They change the vocabulary.
Exactly. They call them strategic necessities or administrative tasks. Let's say you're that mid-level manager and you know a certain supplier uses exploited labor, but your department is facing deep budget cuts and your team's jobs are on the line.
Okay. Stressful situation.
Very. If you present the problem as a moral crisis, saying we are participating in human suffering, it demands massive disruptive action. But if you reframe it as a supply chain optimization issue, the moral weight of the choice is bleached out by the corporate jargon. You aren't doing something wrong. You are just managing logistics.
Right. And the psychological engine driving that is motivated reasoning. You want to keep your job, you want to protect your team, you want to get the promotion so you can provide for your family. So you justify these small incremental infractions to maintain a positive moral self-image. You tweak a metric here to satisfy the shareholders. You look the other way on a safety violation there to meet a shipping deadline. And slowly, without ever realizing it, you are rewriting your internal moral code. You are breathing in the carbon monoxide.
Which leads directly into a concept explored by researchers Knapp and Fingerhut, known as ethical settling.
Ethical settling. That sounds depressing just saying it out loud.
It is a tragic shift. Ethical settling occurs when an individual or an entire organization moves away from aspirational ethics. Aspirational ethics is asking, what is the highest, most just, most honorable thing I can do in this situation?
But people abandon that.
Under the crushing weight of systemic pressure, yes, they abandon that question. They settle for guiding their decisions by the absolute minimum required by laws or compliance codes.
It's the just good enough mindset.
Precisely. It is a mindset designed purely to avoid punishment or legal liability rather than striving for exemplary conduct. Is it strictly illegal? Becomes the only question. Replacing, is it right?
And if we want to understand exactly how the human brain pulls off this trick of self-deception, we have to talk about Albert Bandura. Bandura is an absolute giant in the field of psychology, and his work on the mechanisms of moral disengagement is staggering. He basically explains how modern institutions and the people within them deactivate their moral self-regulation without feeling a shred of guilt.
Bandura's theory is essential because it starts with a deeply optimistic premise, actually. It says human beings generally have strong self-regulatory mechanisms. We inherently know right from wrong, and doing wrong causes us psychological distress.
Right.
But he discovered that we possess cognitive maneuvers that allow us to temporarily deactivate those mechanisms. We grant ourselves psychological hall passes.
He outlined 8 specific mechanisms. We won't list them all like a textbook, but let's really dig into the ones that are most pervasive in our modern institutions right now. The ones that are responsible for the polycrisis we are living in.
A phenomenal place to start is euphemistic labeling. We touched on this with ethical fading, but Bandura formalized it. This is the practice of cloaking harmful or destructive behavior in sanitizing bureaucratic jargon. Language is the architecture of thought, and if you change the words, you change the emotional reality of the action.
Give me a real-world example of how powerful this is.
Think about the corporate world. When a massive conglomerate decides to terminate thousands of employees to artificially boost their quarterly stock price, the executives don't send out a memo saying, "We are destroying thousands of livelihoods to enrich ourselves." They say, "We are engaging in strategic right-sizing," or "We are exploring organizational synergies."
Or in geopolitics.
Right.
A government doesn't admit to bombing innocent neighborhoods. They call it collateral damage.
Exactly. Euphemistic labeling sanitizes the blood right off the action. Another incredibly common mechanism, especially in complex modern societies, is the diffusion of responsibility.
This one is huge. This is the reason why getting anything fixed at a massive corporation or government agency feels impossible.
Because diffusion of responsibility subdivides harmful tasks across a massive, complex system. Imagine a board of directors, a series of subcommittees, regional managers, and frontline supervisors. If an unethical policy is implemented, say, a bank illegally opening accounts in customers' names to meet quotas, the blame is shattered into 1,000 pieces.
Everyone points fingers.
Right. The CEO blames the aggressive middle managers. The middle managers blame the unrealistic quotas set by the board. The frontline workers say they were just following orders to keep their jobs.
Which is actually another mechanism entirely wrong. Displacement of responsibility. I was just following orders.
Yes. But when you combine displacement and diffusion, you create an environment where a massive system can perpetrate profound harm, yet no single human being within that system feels personally culpable for the final disastrous outcome. Everyone feels like a tiny, powerless cog in a machine they didn't build.
It's just policy. How many times have we heard that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's just policy.
And a truly insidious manifestation of all this cognitive trickery is the widespread use of the agentless passive voice in public relations and crisis management. It creates the linguistic illusion that reprehensible acts are the work of nameless mechanical forces rather than human choices.
The classic example is the politician standing at the podium saying, mistakes were made.
Not, I made a mistake. Or a corporation causing an environmental disaster and releasing a statement saying, an unfortunate discharge occurred. My favorite absurd example of this from linguistic studies is a driver trying to explain a car crash on an insurance form by writing, the telephone pole was approaching rapidly.
It completely removes human agency from the equation. The telephone pole just jumped out at me. But while we can laugh at the absurdity of the language, the reality for the people on the ground is devastating. Because when you are a frontline worker, a teacher, a low-level manager, a social worker, and you have to navigate these highly compromised, euphemistic, ethically fading systems every single day, it leads to immense spiritual suffering.
And here we have to make a vital distinction in the psychological literature between moral distress and moral injury. They are not the same thing, though one leads to the other.
Right. Break down moral distress first.
Moral distress occurs when you, as an individual, know the ethically correct action to take. Your internal compass is working perfectly, but you are completely constrained from taking that action by the system's rigid rules, a lack of resources, or direct threats to your livelihood.
The sources use the incredibly poignant example of healthcare workers during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic.
It is perhaps the most vivid modern example we have. Nurses and doctors were facing constantly shifting bureaucratic guidelines, massive systemic shortages of equipment, and profound social inequities in who was receiving care. They were constantly placed in agonizing, impossible situations.
Like what?
Well, a nurse might know that a dying patient needs their family by their side, but hospital policy strictly forbids it. The nurse is forced to enforce a rule that violates their deepest professional and human integrity. That friction, knowing what is right but being forced to do what is wrong, creates massive surges in moral distress.
And you can only endure that friction for so long. When you leave moral distress unresolved, when you force a human being to operate in that state for months or years, it curdles. It metabolizes into something much darker.
Moral injury.
Moral injury is not just stress. It is a deep, lacerating spiritual wound. It is caused by perpetrating, failing to prevent, or simply having to bear witness to acts that transgress your most deeply held moral beliefs. It is the trauma of feeling like you have lost your own goodness because of the system you are trapped in. And the final stage of that tragic attrition is moral fatigue. We have to remember that the cognitive and emotional resources required to make ethical decisions, to fight back against a corrupt system, are finite.
They are highly depletable. When you are spiritually exhausted from fighting the current of a fading system, your soul eventually just gives up. You start withdrawing. You tolerate the cheating. You accept the systemic corruption, not because you agree with it, but simply because you no longer have the stamina to care. You succumb to the carbon monoxide.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and take stock of where we are. Our agency has been paralyzed by the learned helplessness engineered by algorithms and by the suffocating conformity of social mobs. Internally, our ethics are fading away through incremental compromises, moral disengagement, and the crushing weight of moral fatigue.
It's a lot.
It is. But here's the twist. As human beings, we still have egos. We still desperately crave the feeling of being good. We want to feel righteous. We want to feel like we are part of the solution. And this creates a massive psychological vacuum in society. We have a desperate need for moral action, but zero capacity to actually execute it. So what happens?
Something very artificial.
Right. Society fills that vacuum with a synthetic digital substitute. Which brings us to the illusion of action and the commodification of outrage.
This is a crucial and highly sensitive distinction to make. We have to acknowledge that in specific historical contexts, genuine moral outrage has served as a profoundly necessary catalyst. It has sparked collective social action, dismantled oppressive regimes, and secured real justice. But we are no longer operating in those historical contexts. In the modern digital era, the architecture of outrage has been fundamentally altered. It has been commodified.
Commodified? Meaning it's been turned into a product.
Exactly. It has been stripped of its restorative power, its ability to actually fix a problem, and engineered into a cheap tool for social signaling, reputation management, and ego preservation.
Digital moral outrage isn't about fixing the broken world anymore. It's about status seeking within that broken world. The social media platforms have turned outrage into a massive game of reinforcement learning. You express extreme anger about a political event online, and what happens? You receive an immediate intoxicating hit of positive social feedback. Likes, retweets, algorithmic amplification, comments praising your bravery.
Neurologically, it is identical to a slot machine. The platform is training you, through dopamine hits, to express even more extreme anger in the future to get that same level of validation.
Philosophers Justin Tosi and Brandon Warmke have done some absolutely brilliant work categorizing this behavior. They call it moral grandstanding, which they define as using moral talk specifically for self-promotion rather than for the pursuit of justice. And they identify four specific abuses of moral discourse that are currently eroding our capacity for civil society. Let's dig into a couple of the most prominent ones.
One of the most visible abuses they identify is ramping up. This is essentially an ideological arms race of extreme rhetoric. Because the digital space is so crowded, expressing a moderate, reasonable moral stance doesn't garner any attention. So if someone in your social circle says a certain policy is bad, the next person, to prove their superior moral standing, has to say the policy is evil.
And the next person has to say it's a literal crime against humanity.
Precisely. You exaggerate moral claims simply to appear more sensitive, more aware, or more righteous than your peers. The actual nuance of the policy is completely lost in the arms race for digital status.
Another fascinating one they point out is trumping up. This is when people manufacture a moral problem where none actually exists, entirely to create an opportunity to display their own virtue. It's scouring through an opponent's decade-old tweets or intentionally misinterpreting a benign statement just so you have a stage upon which to perform your outrage.
And all of this moral grandstanding gives rise to a broader sociological phenomenon known as performative activism. Performative activism is the ultimate illusion of action. It is seeking the social capital of being an activist without taking on any of the actual risk, sacrifice, or grueling labor required to create change.
Now, if you are listening and wondering how this applies to the broader culture, the sociological text gives some very specific examples. And to be clear, we are looking at these entirely as sociological phenomena. We are analyzing the mechanics of how corporations and individuals substitute performance for responsibility. We aren't taking a political stance on the underlying issues themselves, just looking at the behavior.
Absolutely. A prime corporate example is the phenomenon of greenwashing or rainbow washing. This occurs when a massive corporation heavily adopts socially conscious branding, for example, changing all their corporate logos to a rainbow flag for Pride Month, or running expensive ad campaigns about their commitment to the environment.
The performance of virtue.
Yes. But simultaneously, their actual financial records and lobbying efforts reveal they are actively funding legislators who introduce bills harming those specific communities, or they are continuing massive ecological destruction in the global south. The branding is a smokescreen. It is a synthetic substitute for the costly structural changes they refuse to make.
And we see this on an individual level, too. The sources analyze the phenomena of Blackout Tuesday that occurred several years ago. Millions of people posted plain black squares on their social media profiles to show solidarity with racial justice movements.
Sociologists have heavily analyzed that event, noting that while the initial impulse for many was genuine, the mechanism itself became a trap. It primarily allowed participants to feel a quick, intoxicating burst of virtue and solidarity. And crucially, it protected them from being accused of silence by their peers.
But it required zero friction.
Exactly. Posting a square takes 2 seconds. It doesn't require the difficult, systemic, highly unglamorous work actually required for real community change, like attending local council meetings, reallocating personal finances, or confronting implicit biases within one's own family. It is a neurological shortcut to feeling righteous.
And there's a flip side to this coin, too, which the sources call vice signaling. It's the exact same psychological mechanism, just played out in different echo chambers.
Yeah.
It's acting aggressively rebellious, needlessly tough, or deliberately offensive just to gain political capital within groups that prize anti-conformity. It's still just a performance for the tribe. So if you're listening to this and feeling a little called out, I know I certainly am, how do you tell the difference in your own life? If posting a black square or engaging in a fiery debate in a comment section is just our ego's response to a lack of control, how do you differentiate between genuine civic duty and just taking a neurological shortcut to feel good?
This raises an important question, and answering it demands brutal honesty with oneself. You have to look at the stark, fundamental contrast between outrage and responsibility. Outrage is inherently reactive. It is highly emotional, heavily reliant on the amygdala, and it always, always points outward.
It always blames someone else.
Outrage demands that someone else, the federal government, a multinational corporation, a rival political party, fix the broken system. And because it is fueled by stress hormones, it burns incredibly hot, but it fades very quickly into apathy when the desired result isn't instantaneously achieved.
Outrage is a flash fire.
Yes. Whereas responsibility is entirely proactive. It is grounded in the prefrontal cortex. And most importantly, responsibility points inward before it ever points outward. Before demanding that the world change, the responsible individual asks, what is my own complicity in this broken system, and what is within my immediate physical sphere of control to fix?
And that kind of responsibility isn't going to go viral.
Almost never. True responsibility often happens entirely in the dark. It requires enduring, deeply unglamorous work. It looks like building trust with a neighbor you disagree with. It looks like sitting in incredibly boring zoning board meetings. It looks like having difficult, nuanced conversations with family members without losing your temper and walking out. When you engage in digital outrage, your nervous system is stuck in hyperarousal, dumping cortisol into your veins. But responsibility is a quiet, enduring flame. It is the only thing that actually sustains systemic healing.
Oh, wait. This is the turning point of the deep dive. Because if moral outrage and performative activism are the wrong tools to fix a broken system, what is the right tool? We've talked about how we are paralyzed, how we compromise, and how we fake our way through it. To actually fix it, we have to zoom all the way out. We have to fundamentally change our entire definition of reality.
We do.
And this is where the conversation moves from behavioral psychology into systems thinking and the profound, almost dizzying cosmology of the fractal worldview.
To initiate a true paradigm shift, we first have to understand the mechanics of how systems change. Danella Meadows, who is a brilliant systems theorist, articulated a concept called leverage points.
Leverage points, places to apply pressure.
Exactly. A leverage point is a specific place within any complex system, whether that system is the global economy, a local school district, or the human body, where making a relatively small shift in one thing can produce monumental cascading changes across the entire system.
But Meadows points out that most of the time, society is pulling on the wrong levers. We are obsessively focused on what she calls shallow leverage points.
Shallow leverage points are the parameters of a system. They are the numbers. We spend decades arguing over adjusting tax rates by 2% or introducing a new corporate compliance policy or handing out a few specialized subsidies.
And while those things might be materially necessary in the short term, they rarely alter the fundamental behavior of a corrupt system.
Precisely. Because the underlying architecture remains the same. If a massive tech company implements a new mandatory ethics training module for its employees, which is a shallow leverage point, but the underlying corporate culture still massively rewards and promotes executives who prioritize aggressive profit extraction over human dignity, nothing is actually going to change. The system will simply absorb the new rule and continue its destructive behavior.
So if tweaking the rules doesn't work, what is the deepest leverage point?
The deepest leverage point, according to Meadows, is the paradigm. The paradigm is the shared, unstated, deeply ingrained set of assumptions out of which the entire system arises in the first place. It is the invisible bedrock of reality for that society. If you change the paradigm, the system entirely rebuilds itself from the ground up.
And this is where the philosophical framework of the source texts, Fractal, the Trilogy, and the Oracle 2.0 gets so incredibly powerful. Because these works argue that the root error of modern society, the broken, toxic paradigm that is causing the entire polycrisis, is the illusion of separation.
The illusion of separation is the foundational myth of the modern world. We operate under the completely unstated but universally accepted assumption that we are fundamentally separate. We believe our minds are separate from our bodies, that we are separate from our neighbors, that humanity is separate from the earth, and that we are separate from the cosmos itself.
We view the universe as a giant warehouse of dead matter, and we are just isolated ghosts wandering through it. And when you believe you are utterly separate from something, what happens? Your ego naturally desires to extract from it, dominate it, and control it out of fear. If the earth is just dead rocks, mine it. If other people are just competitors, exploit them.
Exactly. The fractal cosmology proposes a radically, staggeringly different paradigm. It suggests that the physical universe is not a fixed, deterministic, dead machine. It proposes that reality is a highly responsive holographic projection of consciousness. It asserts that reality is, quite literally, a fractal.
Now, I want to make sure we ground this. A fractal isn't just a trippy screensaver from the early 2000s.
Yeah.
In mathematics and nature, a fractal is a recursive, self-similar structure. Mm-hmm. Whether you zoom all the way out to the macro level or zoom all the way in to the micro level, the core pattern remains exactly the same.
Think of the way a single tiny branch of an oak tree looks like a miniature version of the entire tree, or the way the spiraling arms of a galaxy mirror the spiraling pattern of a nautilus shell or a hurricane. The micro is the macro.
So, applied to our current cultural and political crisis, what does a fractal universe actually mean?
It means that the macrocosmic polycrisis, we are terrified of the institutional collapse, the ecological devastation, the geopolitical wars. None of that is happening to us. It is a direct fractal reflection of the microcosmic fragmentation occurring within the human soul.
Whoa.
The outer world is a mirror. The universe is simply reflecting our own internal disconnection, our own greed, our own unresolved trauma, and our relentless refusal to take responsibility for the whole. The macro is failing because the individual human consciousness is fragmented. There is a profound paradigm-shattering quote from the Oracle 2.0 that summarizes this perfectly. It says, "You are not in the hologram. You are the lens through which it becomes real."
You are the lens. That fundamentally changes everything. Think of human society like a movie playing on a giant screen in a theater. For decades, we've been sitting in the dark watching a terrible, violent, depressing movie. And our response, our moral outrage, has been to stand up in the theater and scream at the screen. We yell at the politicians, we yell at the corporations, we tweet at the screen.
But screaming in a movie screen doesn't change the plot of the movie.
It just keeps playing. What Fractal is telling us is that we have to stop yelling at the screen. We have to walk out of the theater, walk up the stairs, go into the projection booth, and clean the lens. And that lens is human consciousness. When you change the state of the observer, you physically, mathematically alter the field of reality that is being projected onto the screen of the world.
It completely redefines the nature of moral action. It moves ethics from a social obligation to a metaphysical physics. It means that the universe is moved by coherence, not by force. When a human being aligns their thoughts, their emotions, and their daily actions in total moral integrity, they broadcast a frequency that physically alters the reality field around them. Under this paradigm, we are not experiencing the random death of humanity. We are experiencing a labor, the agonizing, necessary birth of a new, integrated collective consciousness.
That is awe-inspiring. But, and this is a big but, how do we actually do that?
Right.
We now have this massive, cosmic, holographic understanding of our interconnected reality. But how does a regular person, stressed about paying rent and exhausted by the news, actually polish that cosmic lens on a random Tuesday morning? We have to bring the infinite down to the profoundly practical.
Yes, we do.
And that is what the final part of our synthesis is all about, the daily discipline of moral courage.
To practice this discipline, we must first deeply demystify what moral courage actually looks like. As we discussed earlier with performative activism, our culture has fundamentally misunderstood courage. We think it has to be cinematic.
Right, we think courage is leaping into a burning building to save a child.
Exactly, but that is physical courage. And while physical courage is beautiful and heroic, it is also universally praised by society. If you run into a burning building, you will be given a medal. Moral courage is vastly different. Moral courage is grueling. It is largely invisible. And more often than not, it is actively punished by the status quo.
Because you are challenging the paradigm.
Yes. Moral courage means risking your reputation, your social standing, the approval of your peer group, and sometimes your actual livelihood, simply to align your actions with your internal principles. It is the courage to be disliked.
And the sources apply this imperative across all domains of modern life. It doesn't matter what your job title is. If you are a leader, an executive, or an entrepreneur, you are called to act as a buffer against institutional decay.
That's a heavy burden.
It is. The text highlights a very specific, terrifying imperative right now, the ethical integration of artificial intelligence. It takes immense moral courage for a tech leader or a corporate board to look at the staggering profit potential of AI and demand, unequivocally, that this technology must serve the human soul. It takes courage to refuse to allow humanity to be reduced to mere data points for algorithmic extraction, even when your competitors are rushing to do exactly that.
And if you are an educator or a parent, moral courage takes a different form. It involves actively dismantling that learned helplessness in children as early as possible. In 2026, it means making the incredibly unpopular, exhausting decision to keep children off algorithmic screens as their primary interface with reality. It means prioritizing the difficult, messy work of teaching them critical thinking, emotional resilience, and connection to nature over the ease of digital pacification and conformity.
And as citizens, as neighbors, it means voting and spending our money with conscious intent. But even deeper than that, it means doing the incredibly hard, ego-bruising work of actually listening for the underlying pain beneath the opposing political views of our neighbors. It means refusing to write off half the country as irredeemable enemies.
Which is not easy.
Not at all. It brings us to a concept the sources call the end of waiting. It is this terrifying but ultimately wildly liberating realization that there are no saviors. The cavalry is not coming over the hill to fix the government or save the climate. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
To translate this massive esoteric philosophy into a lived, pragmatic reality, the synthesis provides a vital framework, the 10-point moral courage code. It is essentially an architecture for living a life of integrity in a fragmented world.
Now, we aren't just going to read a list of 10 rules at you. There is a deep psychological framework here. Let's really dig into a few of the most challenging pillars of this code, the ones that require the most friction to actually execute. Let's start with conscious refusal, which is point number 4.
Conscious refusal is perhaps the most urgent discipline in the digital age. It is learning the sacred protective power of the word no. We live in an extraction economy that constantly demands our attention, our outrage, and our conformity. Conscious refusal means setting a rigid boundary. It means looking at the echo chambers of your own political party or the piling on of an online mob and simply refusing to participate.
Even when the mob is attacking someone you disagree with.
Especially then. Let your refusal to engage in dehumanization be a firm boundary that protects your own soul. It is recognizing that you do not owe the algorithm your nervous system.
I love that. You do not owe the algorithm your nervous system. Another massive one is point number 5, values-based decisions. The core argument here is that ethics must cost you something to be real.
This is where the rubber meets the road. We all love to claim we have strong values, but the brutal truth is, if a value does not cost you money, social status, or personal comfort to maintain, it isn't actually a value. It's just a hobby. It's an aesthetic preference.
So if you claim to value the environment, but you consistently buy the cheapest, unethically sourced disposable goods because it's convenient,
then convenience is your actual value, not the environment. Values-based decision-making requires you to make choices based on the spiritual cost to the whole system, not just the financial or social return on investment to yourself. It means occasionally taking a loss for the sake of your integrity.
And then there is point number 9, acting before certainty. I think this one speaks directly to the paralysis we opened the show with.
We freeze because we are waiting for perfect information. We tell ourselves, I will speak up, I will take action, as soon as I am 100% sure I won't fail, or as soon as I'm sure my peers will support me. But perfect conditions never arrive. Acting before certainty means understanding that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is taking the necessary action despite the terror you feel. It is moving forward into the discomfort of the unknown because the alternative complicity in a fading system is worse.
And it all culminates in point number 10, asking the ultimate question. When you are confronted by the overwhelming, suffocating paralysis of the age, when you feel like that utility worker watching your life get swept away by forces you can't control, you have to look in the mirror and ask yourself, what would I do right now if I stopped waiting for someone else to begin?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, these daily, incredibly difficult, seemingly insignificant micro decisions, choosing to refuse the outrage, choosing to take the financial hit for your values, choosing to speak a terrifying truth in a boring meeting, these are not insignificant. They are the keystrokes. They are what literally code the future of humanity. They are how we clean the lens of consciousness and project a different reality. They are the exact mechanism that moves us away from algorithmic doom and toward an awakened renaissance.
Which brings us to our final thought for today's deep dive. I want you to really mull this over as you go about the rest of your week. We talked about how emerging technologies are threatening to reduce human complexity down to mere data points. And we talked about the fractal universe, where every micro action you take projects the macro reality of the world. Think about this. If the universe is indeed a fractal, and if incredibly powerful, emerging technologies like artificial intelligence are currently building their foundational consciousness by scraping our digital footprints, literally learning what it means to be human by observing us. What kind of moral code are your everyday online clicks, your comment section debates, and your quiet compromises currently teaching the algorithms of tomorrow?
It's a profound thought.
When the machine looks at your digital life, what is it learning? Are you programming the future with ethical fading and performative outrage? Or are you programming it with the grueling, quiet friction of moral courage? Because you aren't just living in the world anymore. You are the data training its future. Thank you so much for exploring this profound territory with us today. Don't wait for the perfect moment. Take that first frightening step today, even in the dark. We'll see you next time.